Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, on the web at myfloridahistory.org. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on the program, newly discovered material from Jonathan Dickinson's journal has been published for the first time.
In the fall of 1696, Dickinson, along with a couple dozen other people, including a Quaker missionary, his wife, his infant child, half a dozen or so sailors, and 10 or so enslaved Africans, shipwreck in southeast Florida.
We'll discuss the migration of Filipinos to Florida in 1939.
Like other immigrants and migrants, they came to the United States seeking greater economic opportunity.
And we'll talk about St. Francis Barracks and the Florida National Guard in St. Augustine. All that ahead on Florida Frontiers.
Cast away, trust in your star.
The new book, Jonathan Dickinson's Journal, or God's Protecting Providence, an Early American Castaway Narrative, includes the classic 1696 journal, newly edited by Amy Turner Bushnell and Jason Daniels, previously unpublished material that predates the 1699 version of the journal, and additional analysis from Gerald T. Milanich. Co-editor Jason Daniels is an assistant professor at the University of California, East Bay.
Jonathan Dickinson is an interesting figure. He's Anglo-Jamaican, he's a planter, he's a Quaker, he's a merchant. His family first immigrates to Jamaica during the Western Design and become very prominent landowners in St. Elizabeth Parish. And ultimately, he becomes a very prominent political and economic figure in Philadelphia, where he spends most of his life in the early 1700s before he passes away in 1722.
Daniels explains the dire circumstances that led to the creation of Jonathan Dickinson's journal.
Dickinson shipwrecks in 1696 in Florida, midway on a journey between Jamaica and Philadelphia. And in the 1690s, things were pretty difficult in Jamaica. There's a fair amount of unrest and political uncertainty that was compounded by some natural disasters, particularly an earthquake in 1692 and a French invasion in 1694. So in the 1690s, the family looked to kind of expand their interests economically, and Dickinson, along with his other brother Caleb, left Jamaica for two different locations. Caleb went to England, and Dickinson, on his way, shipwrecks in Florida to Philadelphia, where they were trying to establish reciprocal trade relationships to support their plantations there on the island. And having shipwrecked in Florida, and ultimately surviving and making it to Philadelphia at the interest of the Society of Friends, they asked him to record the events that are published in our journal here.
Jonathan Dickinson's journal is a detailed account of his trek up the east coast of Florida with his fellow castaways.
In the fall of 1696, Dickinson, along with a couple dozen other people, including a Quaker missionary, his wife, his infant child, half a dozen or so sailors, and 10 or so enslaved Africans, shipwreck in southeast Florida amongst the Hobay Indians, who are a subsidiary of the larger group, the Ais Indians. And they spend several months on foot, in boat, being passed along through different groups from Jupiter Island up to St. Augustine. With the help of the Spanish, they're escorted from the main Ais village to St. Augustine and then prepare for the second leg of the journey, taking them from St. Augustine to English South Carolina and then ultimately in Philadelphia. And so within the journal, Dickinson recounts not only their experience as captives, but also the nature of society in these various different indigenous communities and their relationship with the Spanish and the larger Atlantic world.
Since it was first published in 1699, Jonathan Dickinson's journal has become a valuable resource for historians, archaeologists, ethnographers, and literary scholars. Jason Daniels.
So Dickinson's account of his time in South Florida is simply the only English source we have regarding the indigenous people there. Now, there are a handful of Spanish accounts from Pedro Menendez Ford, but they're very brief at best. And so Dickinson's account is a sustained account that talks not only about their experiences, but more importantly, the nature of the Ais, their civilization, their relationships with each other, both internally, but also the relationships externally with other groups and the wider Atlantic world, particularly the Spanish in St. Augustine.
While doing research at the Historical Society of Pennsylvania, Jason Daniels made the thrilling discovery of original material that was not included in the published version of Jonathan Dickinson's journal.
So I first came across Dickinson's journal as an undergraduate student, and once I went into graduate school, I wanted to pursue understanding what happened on either side of the journal. What was his life like in Jamaica, and then what happened to him and everybody else after this harrowing experience? And Dickinson ultimately settles in Philadelphia and then dies there in 1722. So a lot of his personal records are archived at the Historical Society of Pennsylvania. And so I began my research there, and I was very interested in not only his personal experiences, but also the nature of trade between Philadelphia and Jamaica at the turn of the 18th century. And as I was researching, I stumbled across what was a miscatalogued manuscript copy of God's Protecting Providence, the actual published account of Dickinson's narrative. What was fascinating about that account is that it was drastically different than what we thought to be the only source on the shipwreck in the people of South Florida. Certain things had been rearranged, other things had been cut, some things you could say were censored by the Society of Friends or the Quakers who first published the journal in 1699. And so what's new and exciting is a rich kind of trove of ethnographic material, as we would call it now, that was excised before publication, and also some discussion about the various competing interests of different parties amongst the castaways.
As Jason Daniels explains in the new version of Jonathan Dickinson's journal, published by the Florida Historical Society Press, there is fascinating new material.
So Dickinson records all types of things from familial relationships, ceremonial actions, the nuances of communication between different groups. He also talks about bitter infighting that almost tore the castaways apart that is cut out from the journal. He talks about enslaved peoples using kind of the subversion of the normative social order for their own agency and elevation within that system. Really kind of expanding upon a complicated narrative in ways that make us think more critically about who's telling the story, how they're telling it, and what narrative they're trying to tell to that audience.
The editors of the original 1699 version of Jonathan Dickinson's journal were Quakers who were promoting specific messages.
Well, the title of the book is God's Protecting Providence. And so the idea is that if good Quakers are well-reasoned and put their faith into God, they will be brought out of any dire circumstance. And so the journal tends to highlight the disruptions caused by the shipwreck, the perceived violence, the privation, the whole shipwreck ordeal at large. And ultimately, what they're trying to illustrate, like I said, a patient and faithful Quaker will be delivered from these kind of inhumane circumstances that they're put into.
As subsequent editors have pointed out, Dickinson made some errors of fact. He incorrectly believed the indigenous people of Florida were cannibals, for example, but his journal remains a valuable resource for researchers. It's been nearly three quarters of a century since editors have taken a fresh look at the document until now. Jason Daniels.
Well, the Andrews and Andrews is the definitive text up until this point. It's the only scholarly treatment of Dickinson's journal ever to be published. And it's not that, Amy and I have better questions, it's that we have new questions. The way we understand colonial America has changed, the paradigms that we examine, such as the Atlantic world and indigenous interactions with Europeans are different. And so I think we come at it from not a better angle, but a fresh angle that speaks to the concerns of historians in the 21st century. How do people interact? How does that inform international relationships? How does that inform how we understand indigenous politics? How do we understand early American publishing, censorship, just the nature of examining documents, you know, every 70 years is important. Re-examining those things from different angles provides new perspective and elevates narratives that may have been intentionally or unintentionally silenced through the past generations of historical research.
In addition to the 1699 journal, newly edited by Amy Turner Bushnell and Jason Daniels, and the previously unpublished 1696 manuscript, the new book includes additional analysis by Gerald T. Milanich.
Well, Dr. Milanich is a very well-regarded, if not the most highly regarded, archaeologist, anthropologist of indigenous Florida. He brings, you know, decades of experience to this research project, and he really has us thinking critically about what we know about the indigenous people of South Florida by re-examining the route, by re-examining the place names and Dickinson's interpretations of what he sees on the ground. In some ways, some of the material cut out of the published version that exists in the manuscript version reads a lot like ethnography, and Dr. Milanich is able to unpack what Dickinson's observations in the late 17th century can tell us about our understanding of the indigenous people here in the 21st century.
Jonathan Dickinson's journal is an incredible story of survival, perseverance, and interactions between cultures. More than a research document, the book is an important work of literature.
100%. I mean, the book was an 18th century bestseller. It was published in, you know, more than a dozen editions. It was translated into Dutch and German. It was all done so because it was a fascinating and interesting narrative. I think that still holds true to modern readers as well. I think you can read it for one, entertainment and interest, and you can read it for deep historical analysis and be satisfied with both outcomes.
Jason Daniels is co-editor with Amy Turner Bushnell of the new book, Jonathan Dickinson's Journal, or God's Protecting Providence, an Early American Castaway Narrative.
Castaway, no.
This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Visit us anytime online at myfloridahistory.org to watch our public television series, Florida Frontiers, subscribe to our journal, the Florida Historical Quarterly, and much more. That's myfloridahistory.org. Joining us now is Connie Lester, Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. Connie, Florida has a rich and deep multicultural history that spans hundreds of years, but interaction with Asian and Pacific cultures has a more recent history. A recent book on the Japanese community reminds us that some immigrants traveled west to east to settle in Florida.
You are so right. Stephanie Hinerschutz, a diplomatic historian, also reminded us of a group of Pacific Islander migrants who crossed the continent to settle in South Florida. Migrating from the Philippines, these travelers were characterized as colonial nationals by virtue of U.S. imperialism following the Spanish-American War, and did not fall under the immigration barriers erected against Asians and other Pacific Islanders. Like other immigrants and migrants, they came to the United States seeking greater economic opportunity. The history Professor Hinerschutz explores begins with a telegram to Florida Governor Doyle Carlton from the United States Secretary of War Patrick Hurley. The unexpected July 25, 1939 communication read, quote, "Press dispatches from West Palm Beach, Florida, allege in substance that Filipinos working in Canal Point, Pahokee District were on July 23rd ordered by residents of that district to leave not later than that day, and that as a result, 30 Filipinos had hurriedly left on July 23 and others were preparing to leave," end quote. On July 24th, news of the attack by, quote, "a mob of 200 white farmers," end quote, on the 45 Filipino residents had been published in the New York Times and the Atlanta Constitution. Hurley requested that Governor Carleton investigate immediately, quote, in order that an accurate statement of the facts may be communicated to the government of the Philippine Islands and in view of the special relation of the War Department to that government, end quote. Thus began what Hendershot's interprets in her spring 2018 article as a complex interaction of local, state, national, and imperialistic forces. The Philippines, as well as Guam, Puerto Rico, and Cuba, were acquired by the United States in the 1898 Treaty of Paris that ended the Spanish-American War. Military action continued in the Philippines long after the signing of the treaty, in what has generally been understood as a racist war. Letters written by American soldiers in the Philippines, as well as military and State Department communications, verify the racialized nature of the war. At home, legislators and ordinary citizens debated the American move into the age of imperialism. Would the flag follow the Constitution? All sides of that debate argued from less than high ground, with anti-imperialists fearful of citizenship for non-white populations, and imperialists arguing for continued control over the newly acquired islands without the possibility of statehood. A series of U.S. Supreme Court decisions, collectively known as the Insular Decisions, were rendered between 1901 and 1922. Those decisions determined the status of all existing territories by dividing them into three groups. Territories that would be able to advance to statehood, Alaska and Hawaii, territories that would be educated to independence, Cuba and the Philippines, and territories that would remain in the territorial status, Guam and Puerto Rico. Residents in each territory enjoyed some protections under U.S. law, but not the status of full citizenship.
Connie, the migration of Filipinos raises a complex set of questions. Who came and why did they migrate across the continent to settle in Florida?
Hendershot identifies two groups of Filipino migrants: students seeking higher education who returned to the Philippines to assume leadership roles in the anticipated independent nation, and workers seeking to improve their economic situation. Most Filipinos remained in California or surrounding states, where they faced strong racial and cultural resistance. In January 1930, an estimated 500 Watsonville men rioted, attacking Filipino homes, beating Filipino men, and killing one man. The California violence may have acted as an incentive for Filipinos to seek agricultural work elsewhere. The timing of their migration across the continent also corresponded with efforts in Florida to grow and process sugarcane. Sugarcane production began at Canal Point in 1917 with the arrival of the Southern States Land and Timber Company, followed by the construction of a USDA field station. In 1922, the Florida Sugar and Food Products Company constructed a sugar mill at Canal Point. The backbreaking labor of harvesting and processing sugarcane was done by poor whites, African Americans, and Bahamian migrants. The Great Depression also brought Filipinos to the area. As Hendershot explains, by the time of the Canal Point incident, Filipinos had been sharecropping in the cane fields for 3 years, and some had become tenant farmers who produced vegetables for market. The multiracial makeup of the rural community, and what the Pohaki police chief described as, quote, a resentment of long standing against the presence of Filipino farmers, end quote, came to a boil when news spread of, quote, an episode that involved a Filipino man and a white girl, end quote. Racial violence was commonplace in Florida, which held the unenviable distinction of having the largest number of lynchings per capita in the South. The incident at Canal Point was like so many others: threats of violence, physical assaults, and houses burned. Like previous communities similarly threatened, the residents escaped to a nearby town, in this case, Indiantown, where they were threatened with violence again. In all likelihood, the incident would have attracted little attention outside the state or the county if the federal government had not worried about diplomatic repercussions. Violence against foreign nationals sometimes produced official notes from their home governments. Both the Italian and Greek governments had protested violence and death, of their citizens in Florida.
And Connie, the violence against Filipinos at Canal Point generated more than diplomatic notes between governments, right?
In the case of the attack on Filipinos at Canal Point, a variety of government offices and social organizations weighed in on the issue. Philippine Commissioner Camilo Osayas contacted the governor, echoing the concerns voiced by Patrick Hurley. Governor Carlton acted as minimally as possible, caught between an electorate that would not tolerate a full defense of the Filipinos and his fear that failure to act might result in cuts in the federal funding that had been so important to depression recovery efforts in the state. A number of left-leaning organizations weighed in, the International Labor Defense and the U.S. Communist Party, for example. These groups focused on the racial aspect of workers' rights. In August, the Philippines Barristers Association in California formed the Florida Riot Committee and argued that the failure of law enforcement to prevent or stop the violence represented a dereliction of duty. Further, they claimed that Filipinos were entitled to the same constitutional rights, immunities, and privileges as American citizens. Police Captain W.R. Moore of Gomez stands apart from other law enforcement officials in his call for protection for the Filipino workers and his assertion that they deserved basic rights. His plea to Governor Carlton was not the only such letter, but he certainly stood in the minority. Hinterschitz concludes that the topic of Filipino rights received increased attention by rights groups following the incident at Canal Point. As to federal response, officials, quote, viewed the violence as an opportunity to provide protection to Filipinos in order to preserve the imperial relationship rather than end it.
Connie, thanks for this look at an important part of our multicultural heritage.
You're welcome.
Connie Lester is Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. This is Florida Frontiers. Sebastian Garcia has this look at St. Francis Barracks and the Florida National Guard in St. Augustine.
Allison Simpson is the command historian of the Florida National Guard, headquartered in the historic St. Francis Barracks in St. Augustine, Florida. She's a graduate of the Historic Preservation Program at what is now the University of Mary Washington in Fredericksburg, Virginia. I spoke with Allison during the UCF Veterans Legacy Program, VLP, Institute, a 10-day educational program hosted by the UCF Department of History's Veterans Legacy Program to teach veterans history to K-12 educators across Florida to honor and memorialize veterans buried in Florida's national cemeteries. The St. Francis Barracks is one of the oldest military landmarks in North America. However, as revealed by the first part of its name, the St. Francis Barracks has a religious origin.
This was the southern end of St. Augustine within the colonial walled city, so of the 18th century. Colonel Moore, when he came and tried to take siege of St. Augustine in late 1702, wound up burning all of St. Augustine at the end of his attempted siege, and this property had to be reconstructed. So we know that the first two iterations of buildings on site were wood chapel with friary, and then in the early 1700s, the Franciscans rebuilt using the local native coquina, which is kind of like a sandstone with seashells naturally cemented. So it took about 20 years to build first the chapel. We know that that was completed in 1737, and then the friary with 20 to 25 cells for friars to live here, also to have a school, to have the infirmary, to have the retirement home for all of those friars that were serving out in the fields and the missions across Florida at the time.
Roughly 25 years after the completion of the first chapel, the property fell to the hands of the British during their occupation of Florida, and, consequently, was no longer a religious structure.
The property was changed to a military installation during Florida's British period in the 1760s. The soldiers came onto site. It was deemed to be quasi-governmental because it was partially funded by the crown when it was constructed in the 1700s. And so it was determined to use this for governmental purposes and rearrange the figuration of some of the coquina buildings so that they expanded and doubled in size the chapel to turn it into a barracks for enlisted soldiers. And then the rooms of the former friary were occupied by British officers.
When the Spanish returned to Florida following the Treaty of Paris in 1783, the property remained a military installation. The St. Francis Barracks officially became U.S. property in the early 19th century once Florida joined the Union as a territory. However, as Allison explained, significant changes from its structure, function, and occupants continued during this period.
When Florida joins the United States as a territory, this becomes a reservation or a post of the U.S. Army. So this is until 1900 occupied by soldiers of the U.S. Army. In 1907, the adjutant general, who was the commander of the Florida State Troops at the time, as it was called, the predecessor of the Florida National Guard, he secured a lease with the federal government to bring the headquarters from Tallahassee for the Florida State Troops back here to St. Augustine, Florida's colonial capital.
Thus began the interconnected relationship between the St. Francis Barracks and the Florida National Guard, one that still stands today. However, the Florida National Guard has an extensive history in its own right, which Allison jokingly, albeit truthfully, stated is, quote, as long as St. Augustine has existed, end quote.
About 1 week after the founding of St. Augustine, Founders Day here is September 8th, and on September 16th, Pedro Menendez de Avilés, who is the city's founder and first governor of Florida, calls together his captains of the 500 regulars, the professional soldiers that he brought with him to basically enforce Spanish colonialism's hold on this area of what is now the United States. And so with that, when they leave the newly established and fortified community of St. Augustine, and that's the area of today's Fountain of Youth archaeological property, we know that that is the first authentic settlement of St. Augustine. Left behind is a group of about 100 civilians, and about half of those were men who qualified for service as the authorized militia. So they could have defended this community. They were authorized by the Spanish government to do so. That is the date that the Florida National Guard recognizes as the beginning of a militia heritage in this country.
At one point during the 10-day UCF VOP Institute, Allison gave a tour of the St. Francis Barracks and its museum to the participating K-12 teachers. This partnership was reciprocal, as Allison learned how the concepts taught at the Institute can be applied to her own research.
I'm trying to engage more with currently serving members of the Florida National Guard so that they will reach back and share with me some of their own personal experiences. And one of the things that's come up in this UCF VLP Institute this week is this concept of doing oral history interviews. So I think that just talking with living veterans is a really impactful way to pay tribute to them and make sure that their legacies are remembered.
For Florida Frontiers, I'm Sebastian Garcia, a graduate history student, FHS media production assistant, and history podcaster at the University of Central Florida Department of History.
You've been listening to Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. Please join us right here again next week. Until then, visit us anytime online at myfloridahistory.org. Production assistance for Florida Frontiers comes from Connie Lester and Sebastian Garcia. The program is edited by Giselle Concepcion. Have a great week. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State Division of Historical Resources and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org.